From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sej Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here from San Francisco for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. Critic John Kenneth Galbraith calls Canadian novelist Robertson Davies one of the most learned, amusing, and otherwise accomplished novelists of our time. Today, Robertson Davies joins us. His books include The Deptford Trilogy and The Lyre of Orpheus. Also, journalist Eddie L. Harris heard and heeded the call of the mighty Mississippi. He's written an account, Mississippi Solo, about his 2,300-mile journey down the river by canoe. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by pianist Dick Hyman and cornetist Ruby Braff. And television critic David Biancooley previews the series opener for the new cartoon family, The Simpsons. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Bush administration today denied that it plans to set up a naval blockade of Colombia in order to cut the flow of drugs from that country, NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
For several months, the administration has been planning ways to further involve the U.S. military in the war on drugs. One of the proposals under consideration is to establish naval patrols in international waters off the coast of Colombia in order to monitor seaborne and air traffic coming into the U.S. Today, the State Department's Margaret Tutwiler denied that the patrols constitute a blockade of Colombia.
We are not considering a blockade, only the interdiction of drug traffickers. A blockade would mean shutting down everything, and that obviously is not our intention.
The Colombian government has yet to approve the plan. Some Colombian politicians have called it a violation of that country's sovereignty. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Romania began public trials today of those who fought to keep communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu in power, sentencing a police major to 9 years in prison for attempted murder. Details of the trial, including the name of the person convicted, were not disclosed. The country's provisional government announced yesterday that it is setting up military tribunals to try people accused of terrorist actions. During a large demonstration in Leipzig tonight, the East German Communist Party came under fire for its sluggish pace of reforms. Deidre Berger has more from Leipzig.
After a Christmas break, tens of thousands of Leipzig citizens resumed their weekly Monday night demonstration this evening. Many in the crowd waved German flags and called for German reunification, a trend that started last month. Dozens of handmade posters accused the communists of clinging to power and hindering democratic reform. Tens of thousands also marched against Communist Party rule in at least four other East German cities tonight. Earlier in the day, opposition representatives broke off roundtable talks in East Berlin with the communist-led government. The opposition is against the planned reconstitution of the Secret Service. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Leipzig.
Columnist Art Buchwald won his lawsuit against Paramount Pictures when a judge ruled the humorist original script idea was the basis for Eddie Murphy's hit movie Coming to America. The decision by a Los Angeles Superior Court judge means Paramount will have to pay Buchwald a share of profits from the film, which has grossed more than $300 million since its 1988 release, although Paramount says it has yet to realize a profit. Buchwald filed a $5 million suit against Paramount a year ago, claiming the studio breached a 1983 contract to purchase the script idea. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 21 points to close at 2794.58. Advances led declines 8-7 on volume of 140 million shares. This is NPR News. NASA postponed today's scheduled space shuttle launch. Columbia's liftoff was scrubbed because of cloudy skies at Cape Canaveral. The launch is rescheduled for tomorrow morning. It is the fourth postponement for this particular mission, but only the first time the astronauts were on board, suited up and ready to go into space. Alaska's Mount Redoubt is erupting again in what could be the largest event so far. Bruce Melzer of member station KSKA has this report.
After a relatively quiet weekend, scientists say Mount Redoubt let loose a blast Monday morning. Steve Branley with the Alaska Volcano Observatory stood on the roof of his office building in Anchorage and watched the mushroom-shaped plume 110 miles away.
From this distance, even though the plume contains ash, it will have a white appearance like that.
Branley says based on the 40,000-foot height of the plume and the earthquake activity, this episode could rival the biggest eruption to date. Authorities expect the winds to carry the ash away from Anchorage and toward the south-central Alaska communities of Homer and Kenai. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Melzer in Anchorage, Alaska.
The nation's leading commercial banks today dropped their prime lending rates a half percentage point to 10%, marking the first reduction in nearly half a year and paving the way for many cheaper business and consumer loans. The move reflects the overall falling cost of money that banks have enjoyed in recent weeks due to more liberal credit policies by the Federal Reserve. Stocks on the Buenos Aires Stock Exchange plunged an average of 53% in value today when the market in Argentina reopened for the first time in more than a week. Meanwhile, the Argentine government said inflation in December soared 40%, bringing the official 1989 rise in the cost of living to almost 5,000%. The two figures suggest hard times ahead for the government of Carlos Menem, which is implementing its fourth austerity plan since Menem came to power in July. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Stumpson here while Terry Gross is on vacation. My guest today is the Canadian novelist and playwright Robertson Davies. He's best known for his books in the Deptford Trilogy, which includes The Fifth Business, The Manticore, and The World of Wonders. These books trace the lives of three Canadian men from the small town of Deptford, Ontario, who are bound together by a single tragic event from their childhood. Davies' latest novel, The Lyre of Orpheus, is just now out in paperback. It concludes his latest trilogy about the late eccentric Francis Cornish and the fortune he has left behind. The first two books in this trilogy are The Rebel Angels and What's Bred in the Bone. Robertson Davies worked in the theater in London in the 30s. He returned to his native Canada at the outset of World War II and began a career in the newspaper business. He turned to novels to write the stories of people's lives that he couldn't write about in his newspaper. Davies has said that of all the arts, painting, music, dance, writing is the most romanticized. I asked him why that's so.
You see, people nowadays seem to expect writers to have opinions about all kinds of things about which they need not necessarily know very much. And they expect them to be rather glamorous people like politicians and film stars and so on and so forth. And that isn't really in the technique or the psychology of being a writer at all. Writing is a very solitary business, and extremely solitary business are rarely very presentable publicly, and it's hard on writers to have to put on a show, so to speak.
Do you find it difficult to go around and put on a show?
It's not so difficult for me as it is for some writers, because I began my working life as an actor, so I'm rather more used to that than many writers are. But I know that many writers find it very distressing, and they tell me so. But I regard reading in public as a kind of a dramatic performance, and I enjoy doing that and rehearse it and take a great deal of trouble with it. But writers who are rather diffident about putting their works before the public find it very hard indeed, and often their readings are almost as if they were ashamed of what they were saying, which is a great pity.
You studied acting at Old Vic. What took you toward acting and then away from it, back into the world of writing?
Oh, well, I was very much interested in the theater all my life, from childhood, and so were my parents. And I began life as an actor and eventually ended up at the Old Vic. I didn't study there. I was working there. I was an actor and I was assistant to the director. But when the war came along, all the theaters in England were closed at once, and jobs vanished, and there was nothing to be done. And so I had to change my way of work, and I did.
And is that when you returned to Canada, to Ontario?
Yes. You see, at the beginning of that war in 1939, there was a remarkable kind of lull. They called it the phony war. And there was nothing much doing. There were very, very occasional air raids on Britain. There was no work for actors because the theaters had been closed. They didn't want people in the armed forces. And the obvious thing for me to do was to return to Canada and find some kind of work there. And I did, and it was journalistic work, and that was what I continued with.
You've said of your time, and in part, that you came from a newspaper family, and that in newspapers you know a lot of things that you simply couldn't print. And I'm wondering how much of this material is what has made it into your novels.
Well, the part of the stuff that you can't print in the newspaper is what makes excellent fiction, because if you print it in a newspaper, you're probably going to involve yourself in suit for libel or you're going to hurt somebody's feelings irreparably, or you're going to damage a reputation, which you have no intention of doing. But when you put it in a fictional form, you can use it, and it gives life and vitality to what you're writing, and that's, of course, what you're on the lookout for.
The Deptford trilogy begins with an incident in which a snowball is thrown, and concealed within the snowball is a stone. And you carry the effects of this stone throughout the next several decades, throughout different lives. Were you able, as the newspaper editor of Peterborough Examiner, to also find similar incidents in real life and watch how they've rippled through the community?
Well, that is interesting. You do notice that sort of thing if you continue newspaper work for a considerable time. Something that may look like a comparatively minor incident proves in a few months, perhaps in a few years, to have had extraordinary repercussions. And it's very interesting to observe this. It's part of the pattern of life which a lot of people don't seem to notice, but it's there, and it is fascinating. And you particularly notice that something which motivates an action, whether it may be goodwill, kindness, even possibly saintliness, or possibly malice and ill intention, grows and grows and grows and has an effect, perhaps years later, that nobody could have foreseen at the time.
How were you as a newspaper editor and writer turning out the paper, able to cope with these ambiguities? Because no doubt you noticed them at the time.
Well, you just have to cope with them. It's your job. And I've often said that a newspaper, which seems to many people to be a very romantic place to work, is in actual fact rather like a theater. The show has to begin at exactly the same time every day. If something happens after the paper has gone to press, it is almost automatically not news, and it is just a routine which has to be followed through, and you mustn't deviate by more than a few seconds, or it upsets the routine, it upsets the whole production of the paper.
What was the reason you eventually decided to stop putting out working as the editor of the Peterborough Examiner and spend as much time as possible writing novels?
Oh, well, it was because I had achieved some reputation as a writer of a variety of things, including newspaper work, and I was invited to leave newspaper work and go to the University of Toronto to organize and be the first head of a new college for graduate students. And that's what I did, and I pursued that work for about 20 years, and I enjoyed being an academic very much. I liked teaching, I liked being with the young people, I liked organizing the college. It was fascinating. And all during that time, of course, as when I had been a newspaper man, I continued to write. I have been a writer all my life. It has been my principal work, really, but I have had to do other things and have enjoyed doing them because you have to get a living. And you know, when you start off as a writer, if you make anything that could be called a living, it's quite a meager one.
But you're no longer making a meager living as a writer?
I'm squeaking along, shall we say.
In What's Bred in the Bone, I think you say, for a Canadian to be guaranteed dead by the Times of London shows he was really somebody who could cut the mustard.
Yes, indeed it does, because, you know, the Times has lists of people, and there are people whose birthdays they mention as occurring when they do, and there are people who are worthy of an obituary, and, of course, the top liners are the ones whose obituaries come first in the obituary columns, and then you work your way down until you get to colonial governors and people who have spent a life in botany or something like that. It's very, very amusing. And the Times takes it all with enormous seriousness, and I think rightly so. I think they produce the best obituary notices in the English-speaking world. They're far better than the ones in the New York Times, I must say that.
Did you write all the obituaries for the Peterborough Examiner?
I wrote a good many of them, because I wanted to make sure that they were done in a way which, so far as possible, did justice to the person who had died. Just to report somebody's career as whatever it is that they've done is not enough. You've got to say something about their personal character and their effect on the people whom they met during their lives, because that is really what is remembered when they die.
To extrapolate sort of enormously from that, it seems in many ways like the Deptford trilogy and your other books, The Stories of Francis Cornish, are enormous, elaborate obituaries of those people.
They are, in a sense. You see, the Deptford trilogy begins in Fifth Business with the anger of the leading character, Dunstan Ramsay, because in the newsletter of the school, which he has served very faithfully for over nearly 40 years, he's described as if he'd been nothing except rather a dull history teacher whose life had meant nothing at all. And he proceeds to tell what his life has been and what adventures he's had, what emotional crises he's experienced, of his love affairs, of his enmities, and of his perpetual observation of the effect of that first incident when the snowball with the stone in it was thrown and hit a woman in the street. And that is the story of his life, and it shows that the supposedly dull man has actually lived a life of quite extravagant adventure.
There was a time when you were writing, and you were writing a different kind of book than you are now, and you said that you had three fathers who died. They were like mentors to you, and once they had all died, you were able to move on and lead your own sort of adventuresome life in a new kind of way. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, you see, I think that a very great many people have more than one father. Very rarely does anybody have more than one mother. But I had three people in my life who influenced me very, very strongly, all in quite different ways. One, of course, was my own natural father. And then I had another man who described himself to me as my father in art. And that was Tyrone Guthrie, the theatrical director, who, in a sense, freed my imagination because he was an immensely imaginative person. And then I learned a great deal also from a third man who was a Canadian. And he was called by his full title, the Right Honorable Vincent Massey. And he had been a diplomat all his life, and I learned a great deal from him about diplomacy. And that's the three fathers, you see. Tyrone Guthrie died rather earlier than the other two, but my own father and Vincent Massey both died in 1967. And I felt that, in a sense, at that time, something had been completed in my life. My education had been finished, although I was by that time well into middle age and perhaps even past it. But I felt a certain freedom. I felt after that that I was on my own, that I did not have to explain to anyone, I did not have to be accountable to anybody, and I could say and write as I pleased. And that's what I did.
What had inhibited you before that to not, say, have written as you pleased?
Well, you see, I know it sounds absurd for a grown man to say so, but I would have very much regretted writing anything that would have given pain to my parents. And so I didn't. And although that left me a very wide range of things to write about, because they were by no means small-spirited or excessively limited people, there were things, particularly about sex and about morality, which would have grieved them if I had dealt with them as I did subsequently. So, when they were dead, I was able to go ahead as I wished to do.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds peculiar, but I think more people are influenced by their parents right up to the time of their parents' death than would be ready to admit it. And if that is not what has happened, I don't think their parents could have been very effective people.
Well, you've said that childhood is that matrix from which a life grows, and clearly that influence is there all the way
through.
Yes,
so indeed. You take in things perhaps almost before you learn to speak, which stay with you all your life, attitudes and feelings about things which never desert you. They lie so deep that I doubt if even the most profound and deep-searching psychoanalysis would fish them out.
My guest is Canadian novelist Robertson Davies. His books include What's Bred in the Bone, The Fifth Business, and The Lyre of Orpheus. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio. Thank you.
My guest is Canadian novelist Robertson Davies. You may know him from his visage that often appears on book jackets with a wonderful flowing white beard that some people have said makes him look like a George Bernard Shaw, and others say that you look a bit like a Santa Claus. How did you first start growing a beard?
Well, when I was 28 years old, I got quite serious flu, and I was in bed for 3 weeks, during which time I didn't shave. And I thought, you know, this is very interesting. I seem to have grown the beginnings of a beard. Why don't I just go ahead? And I have never shaved since. I don't look in the least like Bernard Shaw. and I, God knows, do not look like the popular idea of Santa Claus.
In your books, there's a mix of Jungian philosophy and ideas, mythology, religious influences, the horoscopes and the positions of the stars come in. Do you have a cohesive sort of religious or spiritual view of the world that you try to come across, or is it...
I wish I had, but I can't lay claim to it because one is perpetually encountering things which run contradictory to what you had previously believed to be true. I don't believe in astrology or alchemy or any of that sort of thing, but I am intensely interested in why some people, and very, very intelligent people, people of astonishing intellectual scope, did believe it. And so I think that it cannot be entirely set aside. We can't say that somebody with the intellect of St. Augustine, for instance, was a fool because he believed in astrology. If it was good enough for St. Augustine, it at least deserves a look from us today. And I think that it is just perhaps another way at arriving at certain psychological truths or making educated guesses about things. As for religion, I think that my feelings about religion are very much conditioned by the derivation of the word from a Latin verb which means to look attentively and closely at what presents itself to you in life. And if you do look attentively at what happens in life, it's astonishing what revelations appear to you. You know, in one of the Gospels, which didn't get into the Bible, the Gospel of St. Thomas, he says, "The kingdom of God is spread before you, and you see it not." And I think that that is a very, very wise saying. If we looked with care at what we do in our daily lives, or even in part of what we do in our daily lives, we would observe things which would illuminate us and astonish us and provide us with a sense of the enormous scope of life and the adventure of life, which a great many people don't seem to have and which they desire but cannot find. And that makes for a great deal of pessimism and a great deal of egotistical assertion, you know, that life is just a can of worms. It isn't, all unless you recognize, of course, that worms are uncommonly interesting creatures.
What do you think would work as a guide, then, for those who are feeling pessimistic or lost?
Well,
Is it a mix and an amalgam of all of this? Is it a science? Science surely isn't then the answer.
I think that it is really much simpler than that. It is not a thing that you can do through acquiring a technique or going to a guru or something of that sort, unless that particularly helps you. It is a question of quieting your own spirit and looking inward and trying to get free of the distractions and the follies and the superficialities of everyday life, and to recognize that the things that you necessarily have to do in order to keep up your daily life are important, but they are not perhaps the most important things that you know, and that they may not be as severely limited as you suppose. I don't know if I'm making any sense or not, but that's as well as I can put it.
Did you have this sense about the value of reflection when you were running the newspaper?
Yes, indeed I did. I had to have it.
Uh-huh.
I had to recognize that although I was presenting what seemed to be the daily news to a very considerable community in size, there were endless, extremely important things which could not be accommodated in a newspaper or which would be missed in a newspaper. I remember a great many years ago, it was in 1950, when Dr. C.G. Jung died. Mine was the only newspaper in Canada which paid any editorial attention to the fact. And I wrote an editorial that said one of the great men of our time has died. Sigmund Freud died in 1939, and that was the end of what had been an extraordinary era in the investigation of the human spirit. The death of C.G. Jung completes another chapter in perhaps one of the greatest lines of investigation that have ever been disclosed in our century. And, you know, I was astonished that no other newspapers seemed to say anything about this. I think one of the very few papers in the United States that said much about it was the New York Times. It's amazing how a very great man can disappear from the world, and it is some politician or a sports figure or something who gets all the news.
You have a great deal of fun, I think, with the names of the people in your books. The characters, for instance, in The Lyre of Orpheus are a great hoot to read aloud. There's Wally Crottle, even fun to say aloud, Dr. Gunilla Dahl-Soot, and Hulda Schnackenberg, also called Schnack in the book.
Yes, but you see, people think that those names are so extraordinary, but there are several Schnackenbergs in the Toronto Telephone Book and a great many more in the New York Telephone Book. And Dr. Dahl-Soot, that is a name that would cause no amazement in Sweden or Norway at all, because there are lots of Dahls and there are lots of Soots. And these names fascinate me because I think that names are uncommonly interesting if you interest yourself in where they have come from, what they originally meant, and how they got attached to the people who bear them at present. You know, everybody knows a certain number of people who have extraordinary names. I remember when I was a little boy, my parents knew a man called Hamlet Pendlebury. Now, if I put somebody called Hamlet Pendlebury in a book of mine, everybody would assume that he was a comical character. Nobody could have a name like that who wasn't a funny man. And yet, Pendlebury himself was a very solemn character, and actually he made his living selling neckties. People don't consider how very interesting and strange names often are.
Well, I have a question about your name, for instance. Do you think you would have been a different kind of writer if you'd been Bob Davies instead of Robertson Davies?
Oh, possibly, but I wouldn't have remained Bob Davies for very long. I would have changed it. You can change your name, you know, and I think mm-hmm. people ought to do it more often than they do.
Robertson Davies' latest novel, The Lyre of Orpheus, has just been published in paperback. His earlier books include The Fifth Business, The Manticore, and What's Bred in the Bone. I'm Sej Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a philosopher looks at health care. If the same amount of money that pays for one bone marrow transplant can instead provide prenatal care for 1,500 pregnant women, what's the ethical choice on where we spend our money? Daniel Callahan, director of the Hastings Center, raises this and other ethical questions facing medicine today. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sej Thompson with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on her midwinter holiday. One of television critic David Bianculli's favorite TV shows is Rocky and Bullwinkle. Now David has discovered a new weekly cartoon program which he finds just as funny and just as subversive. We'll hear his review of The Simpsons later on today's Fresh Air. And journalist Eddie L. Harris. When he grew up in St. Louis, he feared the Mississippi River that flowed nearby. But as an adult, he chose to float the river in a canoe. Today, Eddie L. Harris joins us to talk about his 2,300-mile journey, his account, Mississippi Solo. That and more on today's Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Problems today for Eastern Europe's new reform-minded governments, with both protest and ethnic unrest. In Bulgaria, parliament is facing crippling general strikes in at least four cities, along with street demonstrations. In Hungary, the government put into practice today across-the-board price increases as producers were freed from state pricing controls and subsidies were lifted. A court in Romania carried out the first trials today for the members of the former president's security service, known as Securitate. The trials were ordered by the National Salvation Front, or the interim government, for those who were arrested during fighting against the revolution. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Bucharest.
The special court handed down a 9-year jail sentence today. A police major was convicted of attempted murder. This is the first sentence handed down for what the National Salvation Front calls the terrorists who supported the regime of Nicolae Ceaușescu. The trials are expected to continue. Human rights groups have criticized these trials because the National Salvation Front has failed to give the numbers of Securitate arrested or the conditions in which they're held. It's not known when the ex-members of Ceaușescu's government are to be tried. Many of them have been arrested, including the Ceaușescu's son, Nicu. In Bucharest, this is Deborah Amos.
Today in South Africa, Winnie Mandela, the wife of jailed black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela, emerged smiling after a 3-hour visit with her husband at a prison near Cape Town. She believes her husband will be freed soon. Colin Blaine of the BBC has more from Johannesburg.
After visiting her husband, Mrs. Winnie Mandela said it was the first time she'd accepted it as a reality that he'd be set free this year. She said she was very happy, extremely delighted. Nelson Mandela had called her to the prison to discuss preparations for his release, something he'd never talked about before. But now, he too expected his freedom. The release of Nelson Mandela is known to be high on the agenda of South Africa's President F.W. de Klerk, who has promised reforms and a share of political power for black people. It's clear from Mrs. Mandela's comments that she believes she doesn't have much longer to wait to be reunited with her husband. Since they were married in 1958, they've spent just 4 years together. Nelson Mandela has been in prison for 27 years, most of those serving a life sentence for sabotage and trying to overthrow white minority rule.
Colin Blaine of the BBC in Johannesburg. In New York City today on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 21 points to close at 2,794.37 on volume of some 140 million shares. Trading was only moderate as advancing stocks edged out declines by a margin of 4-3. And the Agriculture Department announced today that China has bought 300,000 metric tons of wheat.
This is Fresh Air. Pianist Dick Hyman and cornetist Ruby Braff have been playing as a duo off and on since 1975. Dick Hyman is probably best known for his nostalgic scores for most of Woody Allen's recent films, but he's also recorded the music of Scott Joplin and Irving Berlin. Ruby Braff is widely acknowledged as one of the most melodic and swinging brass players in jazz, heavily indebted to Louis Armstrong. On their new album, Hyman and Braff revive an old jazz tradition, playing tunes from a Broadway show. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Nobody knew it at the time, but when Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady opened on Broadway in the mid-1950s, it marked the end of an age. Until then, jazz musicians had often turned to the musical stage for material. My Fair Lady was no exception. Drummer Shelly Mann recorded a hit jazz version of the score in 1957 with Andre Previn on piano. But My Fair Lady was the last musical to really catch jazz musicians' interest. Maybe because it was the last musical to have more than one or two melodies anyone could remember. You just don't hear a lot of jazz musicians playing tunes from Annie or Cats. That's cornetist Ruby Braff and pianist Dick Hyman on their album Music from My Fair Lady on the Concord Jazz label. If you're over 30, you probably recognize that song as On the Street Where You Live. You probably also notice that Ruby Braff took some liberties with it, though if he'd twisted it too far, you wouldn't have recognized it. That creative reshaping of a melody is what Ruby Braff is great at. It's one thing he got from his prime inspiration, Louis Armstrong, from whom he also inherited an irresistibly rich brass sound. One thing I really like about this album is how Braff and Hyman dicker with the material without undermining it. Check out the way they sneak up on this next tune. Right, that's Wouldn't It Be Loverly. Dick Hyman is a living repository of the history of jazz piano. He knows his blues and boogie-woogie, but he really excels at playing stride piano. That style's based on the left-right, striding bass figures that ragtime took from march music. But stride pianists turn the ragtimer's marching basses into something more jaunty. Here's Dick Hyman on Without You. Hyman brings out a little of Earl Hines' wacko left hand there as well. But he doesn't limit his borrowings to jazz pianists. On The Rain in Spain, his tango bass line and descending chromatics echo French composer Darius Milhaud's Brazilian pieces of the early 1920s. Hyman has the good ear and good taste to make eclecticism work, and he draws connections that might never occur to you on your own. Like, did you ever notice how much Frederick Lowe's tune, With a Little Bit of Luck, resembles the old novelty, Listen to the Mockingbird? Braff gets in on the act too, slipping quotes from Willow Weep for Me or Take the A-Train into Wouldn't It Be Loverly. Working quotes into a solo can be a parlor game for musicians, just as spotting them can be for critics. But here the quoting has a point. It broadens the frame of reference. Here are two musicians whose styles are based in the 1920s, quoting songs from the 30s and 40s while playing music from the 50s and the 1980s. For Hyman and Braff, paying tribute to stride pianists, early cornet kings, and great old pop composers isn't antiquarianism. They aim to prove that the art of those masters is as alive as ever today.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Eddie Harris decided to canoe the entire length of the Mississippi River alone. His family and friends told him he was crazy. He'd only been in a canoe a few times in his life. And he's a young black man, so his friends feared for his safety along parts of the river. Despite the warnings, Harris felt compelled to set out on the 2,350-mile journey, starting in northern Minnesota and ending in New Orleans. Harris was a frustrated, unpublished writer when he began the trip, and out of his experience he wrote an account called Mississippi Solo, A River Quest. I asked him to read the opening passage from his book.
The Mississippi River is laden with the burdens of a nation. Wide at St. Louis, where I grew up, the river in my memory flows brown and heavy and slow. Seemingly lazy, but always busy with barges and tugs. Always working, like my father. Always traveling. Always awesome and intimidating. I have watched this river since I was small. Too young to realize that the burdens the Mississippi carries are more than barges loaded with grain and coal. That the river carries as well sins and salvation, dreams and adventure and destiny. As a child, I feared this river and respected it more than I feared God. As an adult now, I fear it even more. I've never minded looking stupid, and I have no fear of failure. I decided to canoe down the Mississippi River and to find out what I was made of.
When you were at the headwaters of the Mississippi, it was in lake country in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't get the canoe under bridges?
Well, at the very beginning, the river's not very, very wide or very deep. And there are these little footbridges that go across. And the boat was sat too high in the water to get underneath these little bridges.
And so would you try to get the boat under the bridge?
At first I tried to get the thing under the bridge by all sorts of tricky maneuvers, but none of them worked, and so I had to ultimately pull the canoe up out of the water and drag it across and around and down and back on the other side.
This might have discouraged other people as a fairly ignominious beginning to a cruise on the mighty Mississippi.
Well, that's what I thought at first. And I got stuck, as well as having had trouble with the bridges, but I got stuck in the sand because the river was so shallow. And when I sat in the canoe, there were times when it just dragged bottom. And I felt that, wow, what a way to start this trip, and considered quitting even then. And that, in fact, was the hairiest day on the river, I think. It was the longest day. It was the coldest day. It was just a brutal day. And at the end, I considered, seriously, I wondered what folly I had gotten myself into.
One of the things I've found when I've gone canoeing is how incredibly wet you can get from just the waves, from the canoe, from the paddle just constantly moving back and forth across the boat. Did you ever just get so frustrated with the water in your boat and your wet feet that you just say, I'm nuts to this? Or would you eventually become oblivious to that?
No, I never became oblivious to it, and I never got frustrated because of the water being there. But it certainly was uncomfortable. I mean, it was late fall, and the water was cold. And my toes, it seemed, were numb all day long for at least half the trip. And that was just brutal. And in the, you know, after a few hours canoeing, there was like an inch and a half of water in the back, in the stern of the canoe, which I had to pull over and bail out.
Has it occurred to you since then that there might have been other times of year that might have been a little more comfortable to go?
Well, oh, absolutely. But two good reasons not to go in the summertime. And one is mosquitoes. And one is all the other traffic that's going to be on the river. But I wasn't that clever when I decided to take this trip. I wasn't thinking mosquitoes or anything else. I was thinking, I've got this idea now. Who knows where I'll be in 6 or 8 months? Why wait?
Uh-huh. So it was more a matter of sort of personal urgency to just do it then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you left the lake country and the tiny Mississippi and it began to open up, you moved into the lock country. And somehow these locks, I guess, were designed for barges and for freighters moving enormous amounts of goods. And here you were, a tiny canoe. What was the reaction when you went through these locks and were the only boat in them at the time?
Well, initially, the very first lock I came to, which was the St. Francis upper lock in Minneapolis, I didn't know what the heck I was going to do. Had no experience with locks prior to this trip, and was as scared as anybody in a canoe would be trying to get through these massive structures. But some lady came on the loudspeaker and walked me through the process and made me feel as though the Corps of Engineers actually worked for me, and I was extremely comfortable after that. So everybody else I met, most of whom said, man, what kind of a nut are you to be out here in this kind of weather, on this river, in a canoe? They didn't discourage me at all. And after they told me how crazy I was, they actually said things like, well, we hope you make it, good luck, and when you get to New Orleans, have a drink for us.
You took a revolver along. That was part of your kit.
Mm-hmm.
Chekhov always sort of said that if you introduce a revolver somewhere in the first act, it has to go off by the fourth act. And I'm wondering if you ever had to use it, and if so, under what circumstances, to protect yourself?
There were two circumstances, and one was a morning after a night where my tent was surrounded by a pack of wild dogs, and in the morning, a couple of them came at me, and I had to shoot my way out. And the other time, I was in camp, and these two rednecks came staggering through, I guess, actually, because they were pretty drunk, and bugging me a little bit. And I had to wave my gun and shoot a couple of rounds in their direction to get them to leave me alone.
Well, that's sort of a fairly modest description. I mean, as I recall from your chronicle, I mean, you ended up having to sort of dive, and you crashed into a boulder,
yeah,
striking
a rock
your chin
and,
against it.
Yeah.
It sounded fairly terrifying.
Well, at the time it was, but now I try to downplay it a bit because I don't want people thinking this is some sort of adventurous. You know, the book isn't about my shooting with rednecks in Mississippi, and so I try to downplay that a bit. But both times, the wild dogs and the two rednecks, they were probably among the most scariest moments of my life.
When you were traveling through the down the Mississippi, you had to go through your hometown. Did you ever think about sort of just giving up at that point and getting out, and what kept you going? Because you were, what, traveling in late autumn,
mm-hmm,
at that time.
Oh, that was on my mind for a long time before I got to St. Louis. And when I finally arrived there, I was absolutely sure I was going to quit. My family had come down to the river to pick me up, in fact, and I was going to put the canoe on top of the car, go home, and say that's it. But there were friends there too, waiting for me when I arrived. The same friends who had told me before I took this trip that it was a stupid thing to do. But now they were all patting me on the back and saying what a wonderful thing it was. And so partly I couldn't quit because, in a way, I had assumed their dreams as well. And to quit would have been to step on their dreams the way they were trying to step on mine in the beginning, and I didn't feel I could do that. But also, by the time I had a meal and a hot bath and a shower and a good night's sleep in my own bed, I felt I missed the river a bit and didn't want to give it up.
There was I got the sense that there was a great deal of self-doubt before you took off on the trip to the Mississippi, and you wanted to find out what it was in part that you were made of, and I wonder if you found out what it is you're made of.
Well, I think I'm still trying to discover that, but uh-huh. I did find out that I'm that I can face a little adversity and and come out okay. And that's partly why I took the trip, because I was in this very low period of my life, not having any success with my writing or anything else, for that matter. And attacked the river just to see how much determination and endurance I had. And that was a physical test. But it translates to, metaphorically, it translates to other aspects of my life as well. And I've been writing for 10 years without any substantial success until now. So I sort of took this trip, was successful there, and it seems to be leading me in the right direction with the rest of my work as well.
What's happened for you then since you've written the book?
Well, for one thing, I got the book published. And for another, the money from the trip got me to take another trip to Africa. I've just spent eight months in Africa, just back a couple of weeks ago. And there's another book there. Excuse me. And publishers are... I mean, this book has opened the door to the rest of my writing career, I think. Not only is it a book, but it's apparently a pretty decent book. And it's gotten me a lot of attention. And now the struggle to be considered a writer is no longer a great one.
Well, Eddie Harris, thank you very much for being a guest on Fresh Air with us.
Thank you.
Eddie Harris is the author of Mississippi Solo, A River Quest. It's published by Harper & Row. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later is All Things Considered here on National Public Radio. Let's check in with host Robert Siegel about today's news you'll be covering. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Sedge. Today we'll be hearing from East Germany, where the opposition has walked out of the roundtable discussions with the communists, claiming that the communists have not made good on their pledge to dismantle the state security police. We'll also be hearing from Andrei Cădrescu on his visit in Bucharest to the headquarters of the Romanian Writers' Union. And speaking of writers, we'll be hearing from Art Buchwald about his evident victory in court today, claiming that it was his idea, his movie treatment, that led eventually to the writing of Coming to America, and also what polls tell us about what things whites and blacks think the same about and what we think differently about.
Well, that should be reason enough, but there's even more on All Things Considered coming up later today here on National Public Radio. Last month, Fox Broadcasting Company presented back-to-back Christmas specials featuring the cartoon Simpson family and the cartoonish Married with Children Bundy family, drawing the biggest audience in its four-year history. This weekend, The Simpsons becomes a weekly series, and television critic David Bianculli has this review.
The capsule history of The Simpsons is the cartoonist Matt Groening took the funny bunny from his Life in Hell comic strip, made the features only slightly more human, and created a strange-looking family called The Simpsons. There's Homer the dad, Marge the mom, Bart the brat, Lisa the know-it-all, and Maggie the baby. For a few years now, The Simpsons have appeared in very short segments on The Tracy Ullman Show, a variety series on Fox. That's the history so far, but there's more history about to be made. When it premieres as a regular series this weekend, The Simpsons will become the first primetime cartoon series since the 60s, the days of the Jetsons and Johnny Quest and the Flintstones. If The Simpsons is close in spirit to any of the shows from that era, though, it's to Rocky and Bullwinkle, which I loved as a kid. Who am I kidding? I love it now. And I love The Simpsons, too. It's just as funny, just as outlandish, and just as subversive. In the premiere episode, Bart gets in trouble for drawing graffiti on the school building, and it looks like there's more trouble ahead when the teacher passes out an IQ test to Bart's class.
Bart, I hope you won't bear some sort of simple-minded grudge against me. I was merely trying to fend off the desecration of the school building.
Eat my shorts.
Pardon?
No, I don't want you to worry, class. These tests will have no effect on your grades. They merely determine your future social status and financial success, if any.
The test results, though, make everyone treat Bart a little differently.
Mr. and Mrs. Simpson, this is our district psychiatrist, Dr. J. Lauren Pryor.
What do we need a psychiatrist for? We know our kid is nuts.
Oh, on the contrary, I have some very exciting news for all of us. This aptitude test we administered this morning has revealed that the young Bart here is what we call a gifted child.
A what?
Your son is a genius, Mr. Simpson.
Bart? This lunkhead?
Impossible.
No, we're quite certain. The child is not supposed to know his own IQ, of course, but you can see it's beyond the range of any doubt.
912?
No, you have it upside down. It's 216.
Before you can say gifted child, Bart is carted off to a special school, given special treatment at home, and even allowed to stay up late for an evening at the opera, which he enjoys about as much as his dad does.
Who's the large butt?
He's a bullfighter.
No way a bull's gonna miss a target that big, man.
Who are those people?
Hey, you. When is this over?
It ain't over till the fat lady sings.
Is that one bad enough for you, son? Let's go get a burger.
Even though it's a cartoon, The Simpsons is funnier than most TV sitcoms. It's got better situations and better comedy. Groening has developed the series with help from James L. Brooks, who wrote Broadcast News and produced The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and with Sam Simon, who worked with Brooks on Taxi. So it's got the pedigree, and it's also got the laughs. The Simpsons is bound to be the first hit show of 1990. You watch, and you should.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Bob Alls. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet author Daniel Callahan, an expert on medical ethics. His latest book is What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. And writer Anne Lamott joins us to talk about her new novel, All New People. That's next time on Fresh Air. Oh,